This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor with the historian James Holland. His new book is Brothers in Arms, One Legendary Tank Regiment's Bloody War from D-Day to VE Day. We've got them on shore. We've got them with a mission now. And their mission is the high ground, as James is going to introduce us to a big picture of why watching the Sherwood Rangers yeomanry and their engagement, their gunfight, is part of the larger story of the Allied success from 6 June until the capture of Paris and then all across France and Belgium. James, it's always been part of the story that Caen, the big city, was supposed to be captured within first hours or first days by Montgomery's Army Corps, and that the failure to capture Caen for many weeks was a weakness in the Allied plan. That was always the reporting back home. Not accurate, and you're going to illustrate in your, you illustrate in your story the facts of the Sherwood Rangers and also all of the British and Canadian and Scottish divisions locking horns with the very best the Germans had. You mentioned the 12th SS Panzers, who have already committed war crimes by executing Canadians, but also arriving over the next days, the Panzer-Lehr Division, headed by General Lieutenant Fritz Bayerlin. What is the big picture of why it's important to pay attention to Point 103 and the battle over Fontenay?
Yeah, well, so Caen is you know, Normandy sort of sticks out on a limb in northwest France, and Caen is the hinge because it's a key nodal point. It's got rivers going through it. It's got a railway line. It's got main roads and all the rest of it. And when you from Caen, you can sweep eastwards up towards Paris, up towards Belgium, cross eastwards to the German border, and so on. So, obviously, the French from the German point of view, as they're moving their mobile units, their panzer units, their armored units up into the battlefront, Caen is the kind of sort of first port of call. That's your kind of blocking position. And it's from there that the Germans are intending to knock the Allies back into the sea. And so there is this huge concentration that emerges during the course of June of some 7 of the 10 panzer divisions that the Germans have in the West, all concentrating around Caen and straight into the kind of, you know, the arms of the British and the Canadians. And the Sherwood Rangers, part of 8th Armored Brigade, are on the kind of sort of like the sort of western flank of that Caen front. And the reason they're going to point 103 is because beneath 103 is the Soule River Valley. And obviously, any high ground is useful because from there you can see. You can see what's moving in the valley below. And so it's vital that they hold this, they get to this ground and hold it before the 12th SS can get there. And so they do. So the infantry from the 50th Division and from the Canadians are holding the 12th SS on the left flank as the British are moving southwards. And the Sherwood Rangers are going hell for leather to catch a 103, which they do on the evening of the 7th and consolidate on the 8th of June. But as you rightly said, the Panzer-Lehr are coming up as well, straight into the kind of directly in front of the Sherwood Rangers, who are on the other side of the Soule Valley on the next ridge along. And so for the next sort of 3 weeks, 3.5 weeks, really, you've got this almighty attritional ding-dong going on as the Panzer-Lehr, flush with, you know, highly well-trained troops and equipment and armaments and all the rest of it, and the 12th SS, fanatical, will do whatever they're told, highly disciplined, very well-equipped, bristling with weaponry, come up against the British, and the British and the Canadians' job is to stop them in their tracks, and so they do. But what that means is that for the next, well, certainly till the kind of beginning of July, you've just got this area of just a few square miles, really, is where the Sherwood Rangers then find themselves repeatedly in the front line, not making a huge amount of progress. But what they are doing is attriting the Germans. They're grinding them down. And ultimately, they're winning that clash of arms against the Panzer-Lehr and the 12th SS.
What is Bocage country, and how does that influence the battle?
Yeah, so just immediately west of Caen, it's actually very wide open landscape. It's sort of cornfields and there are little folds in the land, but it's not bocage country. But by the time you get to point 103 and you get to the Soule Valley and Fontenay-le-Pesnil and Saint-Pierre and Tilly-sur-Soule and Christo and places like this, which is where the Sherwood Ranges are, it's absolutely bocage country. And bocage country is where you've got very small hedgerowed fields, you've got little narrow lanes, all with these tight hedgerows on. And basically the unique feature about bocage is that you've got this mound, which has originally been built, you know, many centuries before, as a boundary marker for fields and roads and what have you, on which hedgerows have then grown as well. And that is the bocage. And what it means is very close country. Lots of folds in the land, lots of woods, lots of tiny little fields where your enemy can hide, where you can hide, where the distances of engagement are actually comparatively small. And this is very claustrophobic, very, very intense combat. And it's exactly what the Americans are going through in the Cherbourg Peninsula. And as they kind of push south towards, you know, the ridge line northeast of Saint-Lô, the town of Saint-Lô, on the kind of western flank of the Allied front.
The weapons are important here. The Sherwood Rangers have Sherman tanks, but they also have a tank called the Churchill with a weapon that is called, makes it called the Firefly. What is that?
Well, I've just got to correct you there. So the Churchill tank is a flamethrower. There's the Churchill tank, which is just a tank, but then they've adapted it to become the Crocodile, which is a flamethrower. And the Sherwood Rangers don't have those, but they are detachments from 79th Armored Division, whose special role is to kind of, you know, they have flail tanks that can pick up mines. They have flamethrowers, these crocodiles. But what the Sherwood Rangers have, and they have a kind of, you know, four per squadron of 19 tanks, is a thing called a Firefly, which is a Sherman tank, but it's equipped with a 17-pounder anti-tank gun. And the 17-pounder anti-tank gun actually has a greater velocity than the dreaded German 88mm. So it can hurtle a shell at around, out of the muzzle at around 3,200 feet per second.
Which is important because we're about to come up with the German equipment, which is superior tank to tank, but there's a detail here that's important. I never understood how a Sherman with a 75mm weapon can defeat that German armor, the Panzers and then the Tigers. It has to do with the way the Sherman was built. It's a five-man crew. Its interior is filled with shells, filled with it, and its rate of fire. Now, James, this requires your explanation. How is it that a 75mm that can't penetrate the armor of a Panzer straight on actually defeats Panzers? How do they do that?
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say that the Panthers and the Tigers are superior. What I'd say is they have thicker armor and a better gun, a higher velocity gun, but they're not necessarily better. And that's the big debate, because most people just sort of think, you know, you look at a Tiger tank and it's enormous compared to a Sherman. It's got this huge armor. It's got this massive 88mm gun. You know, you think, well, of course the Tiger tank's better. But there's many things about the Sherman tank which give it, you know, tick a lot of boxes. And it has this incredible rate of fire. There is no tank that can fire quicker. And one of the reasons is because of the smaller shell. You've got a smaller shell, you know, a 75mm shell is smaller than an 88mm shell, for example, or even a high-velocity 76mm shell, which is what a Panther has. And so it takes up less space and is lighter, which means it's actually easier to then put it in a breach and for another one, the empty shell to come out and put another one in. So the rate of fire is incredibly important. And what you notice about the tank engagements in Normandy is that he who fires first, generally speaking, not entirely, but generally speaking, comes out on top. Because in actual fact, you don't have to destroy a Tiger tank. You just have to stop it working, you know, and there's lots of weak spots on it. So if you knock out the tracks, for example, which a 75mm gun is perfectly capable of doing, that's fine. If you hit the gun mantlet, the armor surrounding the kind of base of the gun, for example, and a spark of metal hits the driver and he can no longer drive, you've knocked that tank out. Because they can't drive it anymore. You know, a tank that can't move is a tank that's kind of a sitting duck. So the key is not necessarily to destroy it completely and have it brew up and burn and, you know, the turret fly off. It's just to stop it being able to operate as it wants to operate. And that's all you got to do to knock a tank out. And the Sherman tank has all sorts of things that are absolutely in its favor. It is incredibly maneuverable, so it can move forward and back and sideways and incredibly quickly. Its turret rotates faster than any other tank. It has a gun stabilizing gyro on it, which means it it can hit more, it can far more accurately on the move than any other tank. And it's also incredibly straightforward and very easy to maintain in the field, so that, you know, a tank might be knocked out on one day, but it might be back in action the following day because the backup team, the support team, the maintenance in the field is so good with the British and American and Canadian armies. And all these things have huge advantages over a Tiger tank, which is massive and incredibly complex. And because it's massive and incredibly complex, also requires lots of very big machinery to keep it maintained as well, in a way that a Sherman tank does not. So although as a crew, you're slightly more vulnerable in your Sherman tank, there are so many virtues to it. And there is an example on the 26th of June, 1944, about 5:20 p.m. in the afternoon, in the Rue Mathieu, in Fontenay-le-Pesnil, which is a bashed-about village in the Soule Valley, just a mile or so from point 103 that we mentioned earlier on. And John Semkin, who is the A squadron commander by the stage, he turns around the street exactly at the same time as a Tiger tank is turning around the street at the far end. And they have a face-off only about kind of 200 yards apart. And because Semkin's an old hand and he's been in the desert, he's only 23, but he's a veteran, he's already got a shell in the breech, an armor-piercing shell. And he fires it immediately, hits the gun mantlet, blinds the driver. And in the next 30 seconds, he manages to fire off another 9 shells of high-explosive shell, which creates lots of dust and smoke and mayhem. The German Tiger tank commander retreats into the belly of his tank, and he's just being repeatedly hit. It's not penetrating, but his driver's down. He doesn't know what's going on. He thinks he's under attack by a much larger force than the one tank that he's seen at the end of the road, and they all bail out and surrender. And that is how a Sherman tank can best a Tiger. And what you're witnessing there is a combination of a number of things: the quick firing, the experience, the maneuverability of the Sherman tank. Or in this particular instance, they are able to best a Tiger at, in tank battle terms, is point-blank range.
Brothers in Arms, One Legendary Tank Regiment's Bloody War from D-Day to VE Day. James Holland is the author. I'm John Batch.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.